often for the guys getting into recovery, letting go of that double life is just brilliant. Finally, they get to be themselves. They let go of all of that. There's often a huge relief, terror, but relief that it's all out in the open now. It is waking up from a living nightmare. For partners, that's the beginning of the nightmare. And it's bereavement. You have lost the marriage. You thought you had all those photos, the wedding photo. Where were you the night before? What did you do on your stag do? Nothing feels real anymore.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholfall. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. We are fortunate enough today to welcome to the studio the UK's leading specialist in sex and pornography addiction, Dr. Paula Hall. Dr. Hall is a sexual and relationship psychotherapist with over 30 years' experience. Today, we talk about mindful sexuality, expressing your libido mindfully, how to get help if you think you might have a sex or porn addiction, and how to work through finding out your partner might have a sex or porn addiction. Dr. Paula Hall, thank you so much for coming on This Is Powerful.
Thanks for having me.
I'd love to know more about you personally.
Okay.
Where are you from and how was your upbringing?
I'm actually from Bournemouth, and which is slightly odd because I've done a full circle and I'm back there again without even knowing that I'd come from Bournemouth. I was born just over 60 years ago, just had my 60th. I was actually put into care when I was one. I was in care until I was three, and then I was adopted and brought up in Sussex. So I brought up in East Sussex and had a fairly stormy adolescence, as lots of adoptees do. A bit of sex, drugs and rock and roll and all that kind of stuff. Wasn't so much rock and roll in my era, actually. It was more mods and more into the two-tone. That was my kind of... Left school at 15 with barely any qualifications, just managed to muddle through. Had a portfolio career,
right,
to start off with. I was a chef for a while. I worked in shops. I did all sorts of things.
Oh, really?
And then I trained to be a typist, got a job in an ad agency, in a really up-and-coming ad agency in Brighton, managed to this is Thatcher days when my shoulder pads were as wide as a doorway, managed to wangle myself into some good positions, ended up marketing manager and for another IT company for a while, then became a therapist, started training to be a therapist when I had my first child 34 years ago.
Why was that pivot? Why go into therapy at that point?
So a lot of people say that. So I had a very full-time job in marketing and I was traveling all around the UK because I was working for a big IT company with offices all around the UK. So when starting a family, continuing in that full-time job just really wasn't an option for me. And I loved marketing and I was a copywriter as well, which turned out to be very handy because I went on to write books. And basically, I started doing voluntary work. My first child, unlike the second, first child was so easy. Slept, fed. And I was like, what was all the fuss about? Second child, very different. I started getting very bored. So I started doing a bit of voluntary work. And I was working for a number of voluntary agencies doing marketing for them. And one of them was a counselling service for drugs and alcohol. And they said, I think you'd make a really good therapist. Why don't you train up and be a therapist with us? So the first therapy I was doing was with a drugs and alcohol statutory sector organisation.
How comes that fitted though from doing
because
what you're doing?
It's all about motivation. Marketing is all about what makes people tick. And it's all about it's going to sound really cynical, but bear with. In some respects, I think psychotherapy and marketing is all about manipulation. But in marketing, you're manipulating people to spend their money, give you their money. Whereas in psychology, obviously, we're helping, we don't call it manipulation, do we? But we're helping people to think about their thinking, to reconsider their thinking, to redirect their thinking, to dig a bit deeper, to get in touch with what really, really matters to them, which generally isn't a new car or isn't a new computer or whatever. So it's still... It's psychology. Marketing is psychology, basically, and therapy is, of course, psychology.
So it's a positive transfer of skills then, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Was it strange for you, though, because that's kind of marketing and selling stuff and what you're doing is high-end, fast-paced. Was that completely different to the beginning when you started learning about counselling?
It was, except that working with it, so I carried on doing marketing basically. I did marketing for that charity, for the drugs and alcohol charity I worked with for some years. Then I went and trained with Relate, became a sex therapist with Relate, did marketing for my local Relate Centre and then for National Relate, joined the media team. So I was doing PR, beginning to write books, doing TV, radio stuff. So it was the old marketing hat, never completely went. It's always kind of been there. And I've always enjoyed writing. So one of the first writing jobs I got was as a therapist, but writing for the BBC and writing the BBC websites, sex and relationship pages, which have since defunct and gone. But they used to have a big kind of information spread on that.
Amazing.
So I think sharing information sort of through word has always been really important to me. And also for many years, I've been the main breadwinner. So I also, frankly, needed to earn money. And as many counsellors out there know, it ain't easy making a living if you're just a sole trader therapist. So I needed to continue with the marketing skills and the media work to keep a roof over our head.
And you've had a huge influence in the books you've written, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you writing any more?
I was always going to write a how to give up porn and get a sex life. That was the title, to give up porn and get a sex life.
That's a good title, actually.
That was the next book. But actually, it became pivotal. So Pivotal, the 60 podcasts that make up Pivotal, is the equivalent of three books in terms of the length, the amount of kind of writing that went into it before scripting it and reading it out. Books aren't accessible to everybody, are they? Not everybody. And I think particularly young people. And we know that there are, we can reach older people with therapy. They hopefully may have a bit more money, a bit more open to it. But I've got a real heart for getting to sort of people in sort of more adolescent kind of age, early, late teens, early 20s. And I don't think therapy, traditional therapy, reaches that group, and I'm not sure if they would buy How to Give Up Porn and Get a Sex Life.
Why sex addiction though, from when you started off in drugs?
So I started in drugs and alcohol, and I kind of got it. I wouldn't say that I've ever been addicted to alcohol or drugs myself, but I've certainly been close to people that are, and certainly get it and know how close I've come, as it were. Nicotine's always been my drug of choice. And I think there's, and this is, you know, to do with my family background, I think I've always had a heart for the underdog. I've always had a heart for the person that's not understood, that's not recognised, that's not heard. Yeah. The people that are misunderstood are often the people that I've had a real heart for. I've also nearly always worked with men. I had an older brother, adopted brother. I was brought up out in the sticks, basically, with him and all of his mates.
Right.
I was the goalie. I became quite a good goalie. So
you're safe around men, you know, to handle yourself.
Absolutely. Always been kind of, and then when I went to marketing in the IT industry certainly back then was predominantly dominated by men as well. So very, very comfortable with that client group. And I think I was, so I'd done the couple counselling, the sex therapy with Relate. I was then in private practice. So I got a sort of small private practice, and I began to see clients struggling with what I now know to be sex addiction or compulsive
sexual behaviors. But they'd come to you for something different.
They came to me because under the guise of sort of sex therapy. And what I noticed, what I was basically noticing was, and one guy I remember really distinctly, if he listens to this, you deserve a refund, mate, because I know a lot more now. But I remember he was having compulsive relationships. He was meeting up. Basically, his game was that he'd go out on like a Monday night, he'd eye somebody in a bar and it'd be, right, how many days before I can get her in bed? That was kind of the game. And by the time he had, quite often wouldn't have sex with them because it was just like a game over, all about the chase.
Yeah.
Wasn't really interested in the rest of it. He was married, very happily married, two kids, good sex life at home. Just could not understand why he was doing what he was doing. And I did all the kind of psychological stuff that we analysed his relationship with his mother. It's always your mother. Analysed his relationship with his mum. We looked at his attachment issues. We looked at the bullying at school and we analysed. And basically what happened by the end of however long it was that I worked with him, he had a full understanding of why he was continuing to do what he didn't want to do, but still no ability to stop.
Hmm.
So my hope had been by having a really deep understanding of what was driving the issues, that in itself would be enough. But actually, I think inadvertently, what can happen if you only work on that level is you just reinforce shame. Because, yeah. Okay, so now I know why I'm a drunken idiot, philanderer, whatever, and you just carry on. So it just makes you feel even worse. It feels like you've got no excuse now. You understand it.
So did you feel at that point, you was like, oh, I need to have more experience or more knowledge on this?
There was still no name for it. I went to a conference, a sex therapy conference, and a guy called Thaddeus Burchard was speaking, who unfortunately is no longer with us. And he talked about this thing called sex addiction. I'd never heard it before. And he put, and we go back 20 years at least, and he put a image up, he put a cycle up. And as I saw that, I thought, drugs, alcohol, I've seen that. That clicks. I get it. And it just made sense to me that this was a addictive, compulsive behavior. And actually what I needed was the skills and what I knew as a psychodynamic psychotherapist and as a psychosexual therapist. I need that addiction hat on as well. I needed to really get into the behavior change and really understand the behavior change. And I think it's always been a controversial field. There's still, I get quite a lot of backlash and from some people because it's not a real condition. It's not a real issue. We're just pathologizing diverse sexuality.
From professionals in the field.
From professionals, occasionally from the, Joe Public generally gets it. It's mostly yeah.
There's been some great movies about it, which kind of makes sense. So.
Yeah,
that helps.
And I think if you go back in the early days of sex addiction, the people that were coming out, if that's the right word, with the sex addicts, were the rich, famous, found to have multiple affairs. It was cocaine and sex worker parties. It was all happening in the city. It was a certain profile of entitled man that was doing this. So it started being the backlash was, this is just an excuse for immoral behavior. Oh, I can't help it. I'm an addict. And a lot of people who just don't understand addiction and saying, this is just an excuse. This is just absolute kind of nonsense. And I'd sat with these guys and was thinking, no, it's not. So all those being misunderstood, being falsely accused, not really understanding how it is for them. Feeling like a misfit, feeling like you don't belong, feeling like you're an imposter. Got it. That was just like, they're my peeps.
Is there a difference between a sex addiction to something like food addiction? Because we have to procreate, we have to have family and we have sexual relationships. Yeah. So it's different from alcohol because it's best to be abstinent. It's different from cocaine or drugs. It's best to be abstinent.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of research coming out now about behavioural addiction. So obviously we've got gambling and gaming recognised as a behavioural addiction and recognizing that actually the behavioral addictions, whilst there are lots of similarities with chemical addictions, there are also some significant differences. So craving, for example, is very different with a behavioral addiction. Also, we know with drug and alcohol that if you're coming off drugs and alcohol, there's going to be a detox process. Your body is going to be going through it. Usage it's been, but your body's going to need some support to go through this kind of process. Nobody's died from withdrawal from pornography or gambling. Yeah, it's not. So the whole kind of idea of withdrawal is really quite different in behavioral addictions. Mm. I think also there's more and more research demonstrating, some would say this is true in chemical addictions as well, but that it's a spectrum disorder. You really have got people at the milder end where it's problematic, right through to people that are losing everything, you know, as a result of their behaviour. Yeah. So it's much more of a spectrum disorder than perhaps we would recognise with alcohol and drugs. But in many respects, I think the compulsive behaviour or addiction doesn't really matter what you call it, you're working with the same process, but recovery is different. That's the bit that's different. And that's the bit where having some training, understanding of sexology is absolutely essential, because no one's died without sex. You do have to eat.
Yeah.
Slight correction, Paul. You don't have to. But some really? Would say, I'd rather be dead if I couldn't have. So it's... But you're right, in many ways, it's more akin to an eating disorder. And particularly because one of the things that you're battling with is your own appetite. So your own libido is a trigger, and libido and craving is not the same thing. So one of the things that you're doing working with someone with sex and porn addiction, what they might experience as craving or think is a craving is actually, no, it's your natural libido. You're a healthy human being with a sex drive. It's fine. Please don't, you know, pathologize, demonize that, become frightened of that. But unpicking that from what's a craving is...
That's what I was going to ask.
Challenging.
Because that must be really difficult. Yeah. What about, you say about withdrawal, but the shame attached to it and the guilt attached to it must be, must add to suicides or attempts to suicide or the thought process. Is there any science around that?
Yeah, absolutely. And the research we've done with Pivotal has been, and this very, very similar stats with our pilot study that we did for Pivotal as well, was that about 50% of people have actively considered taking their own life as a consequence of this. And the shame is often, there's another misunderstood area in this field, that some people will think the shame is about the behaviour. Visiting sex workers is wrong. Watching pornography is wrong. For some people, that is part of it. They do feel shame about what they're doing. But for others, it's much more about the amount, the quantity, the infidelity, the pain they're causing somebody else. I remember working with a young lad. It was quite a while ago, but I made this title of my talk for quite a while. He said, look, most lads, he's about 23, 24, most lads my age watch porn, yeah? But I'm a wanker and nobody wants to be a wanker.
That's a completely different view then when you say that word.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's that sense of dependency on it and, oh, no, I'm going to have an early night, actually, and leaving early from the pub. And
I mean, things must change now because of mobile phones, obviously, because before, when I was young, if you was lucky, you could get your hands on a magazine or a friend might have one. But now in your pocket, when you're young, I mean, everyone can access it, can't they? Has there been a big shift in age as well when people start watching porn?
Yeah, it has been an absolute game changer. When I first started training in this, the average profile of somebody with sex addiction was a guy with a bit of money in his 40s, 50s, fairly good looking if it was multiple relationships. If he wasn't fairly good looking, he was paying for sex, right? Basically.
He was getting it no matter what, though.
Exactly. So and it was nearly always about sex workers. That's what it was,
right?
Whereas now the accessibility to sexual services has just absolutely gone through the roof. I mean, it'd be a bit like, you know, crack cocaine just being available absolutely everywhere. Yeah. Opportunity, of course, is a significant contributor to addiction, particularly when you've got opportunity without education and without regulation, which is kind of where we're at the moment. So yeah, absolutely. Once upon a time, you couldn't have got hooked on pornography. You couldn't turn the pages fast enough. You just can't produce enough dopamine. And can you imagine? You've got to go down a phone box and get the card. Oh, Betty, I'm in the mood for a, you know, whatever. Oh, I can fit you in next Wednesday. Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, it's hardly impulsive. It's hardly. Whereas now on the phone, you can swipe hundreds of profiles. You've got ratings now, so your sex workers are going to be rated a bit like you're rating your Uber or whatever, and they can rate you as well. Now, I was at the International Behavioural Addictions Conference earlier this year, and there's a real challenge in the academic community at the moment about how these things should be kind of listed and classified and understood. So just to clarify, sex and porn addiction technically don't exist. Yeah, they're not. We've got alcohol and drugs and substance and gambling and gaming, and they're all recognised as addictive disorders. At the moment, pornography and sex isn't. It's listed as an impulse control disorder.
Is there an argument that's chemically different, the reaction in the body, to why they're different?
No, it's because we got caught in a bit of a catch-22. Most of the kind of big universities and labs weren't able to research sexual porn addiction because it didn't exist. So you go to your ethics committee, you can't research this thing, it doesn't exist.
Right.
But because there wasn't enough research, they didn't know where to classify it. So basically, this is exactly what happened with gambling. It got put in as an impulse control disorder just to give it a label. And then, so it was just gambling disorder. And then when they got a real label, then they could research it. Then it got moved over to addictive disorders. So most people think that it will move to addictive disorders. But there's another issue around the classification system, which is, should we actually just have a classification for internet-based addictions? Because you have got social media, gambling, shopping is becoming a huge issue for an awful lot of people. And I've worked with a few people with shopping disorder. So it's the actual medium that it's being delivered through is significant in terms of its addictiveness, compulsiveness. So you get that with shopping, you get that with food as well. So if you were deciding to cook a dessert, you can guarantee your page is going to be full of that. Obviously there's all the swiping business around dating and that kind of. So the device itself, it's not the device itself is addictive, it's what's on it has become very, very addictive. So maybe porn should just be part of that. Because it's not just porn and it's not just sex. We use these kind of broad labels. But yeah, where does OnlyFans, where do all the webcam stuff come in? I mean, that's not sex. Is it porn? I mean, they're content creators, but it's certainly pornographic, but it's not traditional porn as we would have known.
No, but the effects on the individual must be the same, if not similar.
Yeah.
Say you're 13, 14, you have your own phone and you're watching porn. Does that change your brain chemistry?
Common sense tells us yes, because we know that if you keep stimulating the reward system and if you keep feeding the brain certain information, then it begins to adapt to that. Early adolescence, we know, is a particular risk period because there's also another set of heavy pruning of neural pathways, which means, you know, some of the other stuff you might have learned gets forgotten. There isn't yet the research to back it up. We certainly know when it comes to drugs and alcohol that early usage is very, very significant in developing problems later in life.
Yeah.
We've known that for a long time. But the ethics around this are really challenging. What are you going to do? We took 214 year olds and made them watch porn, 200 and didn't let them watch porn. And then, but if you just try and do a control experiment, so if you try and find 200 adolescents who haven't viewed porn, you're going to struggle. If you do find 200 adolescents who haven't viewed porn, it could be because they come from a particular faith community, in which case, is it the faith community that's been the protective factor or the fact that they haven't looked at porn? So it is incredibly hard to research ethically, much, much harder than drugs and alcohol. But certainly in the, again, the research we do with Pivotal, one of the questions that I ask is, at what age do you think this started to become a problem? And 75% of our users say the problem started under the age of 21. And I think it was about 53% said it was under the age of 16.
So kind of after puberty, a couple of years maybe after puberty.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's, I'm sure that your own faith or your close society or family would have a big part in keeping you from that.
Yeah. Well, and keeping it balanced, because I think this is the other challenge in this field, which is really quite different, particularly from alcohol, which always annoys me. Lots of things annoy me about this field, you'll get to know. But there can be an assumption that if you're working in porn addiction, if you're talking about young people's access to pornography, that you're anti-porn. And I don't really get why that is automatic. If you work in alcohol addiction, if you're trying to work with teenagers or young people and educate them about the risks of alcohol, that doesn't mean you can't have a G&T on a Friday night.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you're completely teetotal. Nobody assumes if you work in the field of alcohol that you're anti-alcohol. And of course, there are lots of people in recovery from alcohol who aren't anti-alcohol.
Yeah.
They're more than happy for their friends to be having a glass of wine, whatever. But if you work in the porn field, there's an assumption that you're anti-porn.
I think the people who are assuming it want to watch it. That's why they're angry about it.
No comment.
Is there a common cross addiction with porn?
With some of the chems, yeah. So, I mean, sex and cocaine. We've known that cocaine heightens the arousal system. We've known that for many years. Within the gay community, there's issues around chemsex. So the unholy trinity, as it's referred to, which is used recreationally by many people without a problem, but for some does become problematic. There's also what we know in working with women with sex and porn addiction, which is a much smaller proportion, but there's certainly a crossover with eating disorders. There's a common crossover with that, but alcohol as well. But one of the things that I see more and more, and I think the addiction community is beginning to wake up to this, is the amount of people in recovery from alcohol and drugs who use porn to get into recovery. You're struggling with craving. You're in the early stages of recovery from drugs, alcohol. You get craving. Look, a bit of porn. It's going to help. And often it's either, well, I didn't know this could be addictive. We have got so many clients at the Laurel Centre who have come from rehabs or are in recovery from other addictions. And they saw either porn was always there, but nobody asked. But since giving up the rest, it's rocketed.
That's interesting.
Or they took it up to help them get off of this because they didn't think it was addictive and certainly saw it as the lesser of two evils. And if the heroin's going to kill you, let's face it, it is the lesser of two evils.
But there's a question there then, Paula, that if you're replacing that or you're trying to soften the blow of cravings, what is that doing for you chemically inside?
Well, we know, that plenty of evidence of this in porn, that it works on the dopamine pathway in exactly the same way as others. So, as I said, there are some differences between the behavioural addictions and chemical addictions, but there are more similarities, which is why most people think you ought to lump it in with those. There are more similarities, and the brain changes. So the fact that the reward centre changes, there's escalation, you need more and more to have the same effect. You need that ongoing kind of novelty, and the decision-making part of the brain basically gets slower and slower and more useless at thinking about what might happen in the future if I do this.
What happens with the partners of someone? Because it must be devastating. You say it's mostly men. Be a partner, whether you're male or female, for this to come to light with someone that's had, I don't know, years of whether it be porn or visiting ladies or workers.
Absolutely huge. Another big distinction in this that's worth mentioning, which has an impact on partners. For many people, there's no side effects to this addiction. If you're gambling, you're losing money, unless you're very wealthy, someone's going to start noticing a financial impact. Drugs, alcohol, you've got the come down, you've got the impact that it's having on your physical health. It's very hard to hide from a partner alcohol or drug addiction for long without them beginning to notice, beginning to wonder what's going on. Your friends start begin to notice. This, there are no obvious side effects. And of course, that happens to the user as well, which means they can be watching 4 or 5 hours of porn every single night for 5 years without any side effects. Then they haven't got a hangover the next day. They're fine. It's only when they get into a relationship it can't stop that they realize they've got a problem. So it has that lack of side effects is an issue for the user, but it absolutely means that for partners, you can be married to a sex addict or a porn addict or long-term relationship to have to be married for 10, 20, 30, 40 years and have no idea whatsoever.
If you're visiting workers, then money is money exchange, isn't it? And there's time. So
yeah, but if you've got a business account and you're away, if you travel a lot on business, if you're away every, you know, couple of weeks on business, then and you know, he always said he was upstairs working. Lots of people are.
Yeah.
We spend, you know, most of our life online these days. So you're not going to suspect every time your partner says, "I need to check on a few emails."
Yeah. 6 hours later.
Quite. So for partners, the shock is absolutely phenomenal. We've worked with quite a few partners who also only found out after their partner had passed away, and that's incredibly difficult. So they've got all the bereavement issues and discovering the history, that because then you get the statements and the various things come out. But for many partners, the shock is phenomenal. And as with most people with an addiction, they are really nice human beings. They are loving. They are caring. They are all the positive things as well. Partners like, God, no, absolutely not. He's the last person on the planet you think would do that. Often they've withdrawn from the sexual relationship. He doesn't even like sex. What? So there's the kind of shock of that as well. And so you've got all the issues around the addiction, all the stigma and shame that comes from society because of it, plus obviously the infidelity. And for many partners, even if it's just pornography, and they don't like it if you say that, just pornography, you've been choosing pictures over me. It still feels like an infidelity. And then for others, it's literally, one client she worked out was over 1,000 sex workers in the 15 years they've been together.
How do you deal with that? Because it's betrayal as well, isn't it?
Exactly.
Deceit, and like all
double
the low
life. For partners, you're doing trauma work quite often. I mean, obviously, there's different degrees. For some partners, at last I knew there was something going. I knew, and oh, it's not me. It was the porn. Great.
Right.
And they're all behind it, and they get addiction. They've got their own story. So it's not always terrible. But for some partners, you're doing trauma work because they didn't know the person that they were closest to. It turns out they were leading a completely double life. They were a complete stranger. And we all think we know our partner. So it's not just they can't trust them. I can't trust myself anymore to make a judgment about people. Is everybody like this?
God, that must be...
So it's the self-doubt. If I didn't even know my own partner, who I've been with for 30 years and called my best friend, how do I know anybody? How stupid am I? What?
God, that's like a earthquake in yourself, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. What we say is often for the guys getting into recovery, it's like waking up from a living nightmare. Letting go of that double life is just brilliant. And recovery, you know, is such a gift. And finally, they get to be themselves. They let go of all of that. There's often a huge relief, terror, but relief that it's all out in the open now. It is waking up from a living nightmare, and it's like a whole new life that they get. For partners, that's the beginning of the nightmare. They thought life was all right. Mm. It's the beginning, and it's bereavement. You have lost the marriage. You thought you had all those photos, the wedding photo. Where were you the night before? What did you do on your stag do? What? Nothing feels real anymore.
How do they, and is that, does that take a long time? It must vary for people to go through trauma work. And do those partners that have unfortunately had this come onto them, is that, would they leave their partner? Because you must love them on one hand, but.
Yeah, so I've just written Pivotal for Couples as well. Now, we've written Pivotal for Partners, just written Pivotal for Couples, and that will go live in the next few weeks. The bottom line is it depends how good the relationship was to start off with. if it was a bit shite, frankly, this really is the last straw.
To leave, yeah.
This is the last straw. But for others, if actually, apart from this sledgehammer, it's been good. What I will generally say is don't rush to make a decision. It's much easier to leave later than get back together again, obviously, particularly if you've got kids. So, and do not rush to make a decision when you're in shock. But if it was fundamentally a good relationship apart from that, and if he is genuinely in recovery, active in recovery, serious about recovery, and the partner does, there aren't any more secrets, any more baggage, then yeah, relationships absolutely can survive. But rebuilding the trust and the intimacy takes time.
A long time.
Yeah.
Why is it more men than women?
So I have a hypothesis, which would be very difficult to test, that actually if you are a female sex addict, you probably work in the sex industry. You're probably a content creator on OnlyFans. You can get paid for it.
Interesting.
Yeah. Very, very different. So I think there are... that there's kind of, you know, opportunities. Generally, women don't have sex with strangers because far more likely, we're talking heterosexual here, obviously, far more likely to get killed, far more likely to get hurt. So women's conditions for sex, I mean, including paying for sex, it's a risky old business because you're making yourself so vulnerable.
Yeah.
For most blokes, it's much safer opportunity. Yeah. The majority of porn is catered for... men, is created by men, for men. There are some female porn creators, but generally women are less visual. And this will come, you know, my psychosexual days understanding this kind of stuff. Men generally are more visual. So this is partly because of the opportunity and the sort of safety issues and addiction that gets more men than women. There's also the kind of social constructs around it. This is what men do. Sex addicts, aren't they all? Mm. You know, that's the kind of, that's an addiction
guy's
I'd like
of a player,
to have.
Isn't he? And a girl would be called something else.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the shame for women when it's compulsive behaviour is really, really quite different.
Yeah.
And the impact it has on, assuming they're in a heterosexual relationship, on their male partners. Really tough if you're a male partner of a female sex addict. Because you're going to get support from your mates? Really? Oh, you lucky bastard. Is probably the kind of reaction you're going to get.
Yeah.
Men cheat, women know it. There's kind of a sisterhood, a camaraderie. There's a whole social narrative around this is what men do.
Yeah.
So we could get into the whole toxic masculinity and all those conversations as well.
Toxic masculinity was battered around for a long time, and I had a discussion with someone because I got quite offended a few times for being sort of put into a category which I don't think I belong in. Do you think that word was changed at all, or in your experience?
I think it became a huge label. It became a stick to beat men with. And like I said earlier, I've always had kind of a heart for men and working with men. And one of the things I feel really strongly about at the moment, I've done a little bit of work with the government on this and hope to do a lot more. Whenever we talk about pornography, we talk about the impact on women and girls. We talk about the violence against women and girls. We talk about how it's acted out in real life, and particularly issues around deep fake porn, strangulation, choking in porn. And I wholeheartedly support that. The impact it has on women is huge, but what we're not talking about is the impact it has on men. And men are victims of pornography as well, and are victims of the messages within pornography, particularly young men who are brought up seeing choking in porn, and then are like, I thought that's what you did.
So they innocently just follow.
I thought, well, not suit, all, so but some, speak, of course, yeah, they do. If that's the only sex education you get.
Yeah.
So we don't talk enough as a society, I believe, about how so often men, and particularly young men, are victims of pornography. Mm. And I think the toxic masculinity narrative became another way of kind of beating men. I mean, we've got the Andrew Tates out there. I mean, they exist. We've got the, you know,
but a lot of guys do not agree with his stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But so I'm also a grandmother now, and I'm a grandmother.
Congrats.
Of a little boy and a little girl, a little brother and sister. And it is, it's really interesting. I've started reading, my daughter's got me to read Boy Mum. It's a brilliant, you've got two daughters, haven't
yeah.
you? Yeah. So I had two daughters.
Yeah.
But Boy Mum, and it is brilliant. Can't remember the name of the author, and I've not got very far through it. But it was, so I've been a psychologist for 34 years. I've been working in this field. I work predominantly with men, so I know all this stuff. Oh boy, just beginning to read some of that and the different ways in which little boys are treated compared to little girls.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh my goodness. Yeah. No, some of that still do. So I think we've got a long way to come when it comes to raising boys, because some of the, what we call toxic, is actually how they're brought up from really a very, very small age, very young yeah. age.
How do you find that the people that go into recovery, they've had horrendous porn addiction or stuff, do they have to be abstinent, or is there a, can they go help, like, is there a healthy balance,
it's
or?
Very much about talking about what is healthy, positive sexuality for them. And of course, it's going to depend on each individual. One of the things I struggle with, there's quite a lot, and part of the reason I created Pivotal, there are a lot of apps out there which are basically sobriety apps. They're about giving up porn and counting days. They're very gamified. So you get a medal and you get to 10 days, you get. And there's this mythical 90 days that once you get to 90 days, you will have reset your brain chemistry. And then no one seems to say what you do on day 91. Back to the porn. I don't know. But there's this mythical 90 days. Now, the 90 days comes from the chemical community, because when we used to talk about detox, we know when it comes to detox, 90 days is a good, sensible amount. The first 30 days are hell. Next 30 days, recovering from those, then kind of move forward. So you get a lot of rehabs whose basic package, a lot of them do 30 days, but their basic package ideally is 90 days. And this got transferred onto porn addiction, that you need 90 days, but there's absolutely no science that backs it up whatsoever. And as I was saying earlier, it's not about physical detox in the same way. It's just not the same language. So early on, it's important to define and think, right, what is it that I've definitely got to give up? So I do a really, really basic exercise, which is what's okay, what's not okay, and what's iffy. I remember one client filled it in. What's okay? What the wife says. What's not okay? What the wife says. Go and do your homework again. But what's okay? So let's assume, yeah, you're in a relationship, sex with a partner, is that's probably going to be okay. What's not okay? A lot of them are going to be sex with sex workers, watching porn, whatever. The iffy section, and we do really encourage people to have that, because, or at least to start off with, because there are grey areas, because and masturbation is the classic one. Yeah. So I'm saying, masturbating in Sainsbury's, not okay. That's definitely not
by
okay.
By the baked bean section, definitely not okay.
But it might be that it's okay in certain situations, certain circumstances, whatever. I think as human beings, we all have a fundamental right to be able to pleasure ourselves if we want to in the right situations.
Yeah.
But so it's there, and that for some people, it's always said, what about social media? What about lingerie? What about, I don't know why you're looking at lingerie unless it's for your partner, but there are bits of, what if I see someone who's really attractive? If I'm single, what if I'm dating? Am I still allowed to be dating? So there are lots of kind of areas of grey. And generally at first it's better in recovery if you're really not sure and you can't work through the okay, the iffy stuff, then put it in not okay. You can always move it, but put it in not
just
okay.
Just to keep you safe.
To keep safe. Yeah. But things like masturbation and, you know, particularly if you're working with young, fit, single guy, you can not have sex until you get into a relationship. I mean, that's, it's not fair. It's also not fair on the person in the relationship.
Yeah.
You sure you want to go out with me? Yeah, you bet. If not your
definitely.
Friend.
Yeah. By 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely not the reason to be getting into it. So yeah. I think having a healthy relationship with your own sexuality and your libido is really essential. And of course, that's where recovery is different. And I think it's going back to kind of the foods analogy. There are really, really good, well-researched guidelines about what is good for us. And we know if you want to maintain a healthy body, healthy weight, eat when you're hungry and eat good food. Mm. And good food, we can give you definitions for. It's pretty simple. In some respects, healthy sexuality is similar. Have sex when you're horny. Mm-hmm. Only have sex when you're horny, which means you've got to identify what your libido is. And only have sex that's healthy and positive for you. But that's not 5 bits of fruit and veg a day and some fibre. That you're going to have to work out for yourself.
Yeah.
Because if kink is your thing, then fine.
Right.
If actually you want to be in a polyamorous relationship, so it's not going to be monogamous, that's fine. But for most of my clients, masturbating to pornography is not okay. Because once they're on it, the ability to control it is almost impossible.
And that must ignite that old
exactly.
stuff as well.
So we talk about mindful masturbation, really, really getting in touch with your body.
Mm.
And it's really interesting working with like younger lads who think masturbating without pornography is impossible. It's like, it didn't come with the smartphone, you know.
Yeah.
I masturbate. It's been around since the dawn of time.
You have an imagination, dear.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've got to be careful with that one because then they'll imagine the porn or remember the last sex worker, which doesn't help. If you're trying to give out alcohol, you're not going to drink this and imagine it's gin. That would be really, really unhelpful.
Mm.
It is much better to really enjoy water.
Wow. That's really,
really taste it. Sorry. The freshness, drink it mindfully. Yeah. Did you ever get that thing where they go, daddy, daddy, I'm hungry, daddy, I'm hungry. You go, do you want a banana? Do you want an apple? No, I'm hungry for a biscuit. Okay, that's not hungry. And this is what we start talking about with clients. I'm really horny. I'm really horny. I need to masturbate. I need porn. No, no, no. If you're really horny, then you'll masturbate mindfully.
But that's brilliant to be that nuanced, isn't it?
Yeah.
And probably necessary as well, yeah. Right? Pivotal.
So yeah, Pivotal. I thought it was going to be short videos to start off with. I have various ideas going on in my head. And then actually no one's going to sit on a train or whatever and watch yours truly talking about this. You're going to be very, this has got to be podcast. This has got to be audio. This way we've got to do it. So yeah, the idea was born about 2 years ago now. So I wrote How to Give Up Porn and Get a Sex Life, effectively. That's what I wrote, but it's called the Pivotal Recovery Course. So it's 60 podcasts, 60. They're about 15 minutes long. It goes through the choice recovery model. So we start off with psychoeducation, and then we start looking at faulty core beliefs. Why have you failed in the past to get on top of this? Oh, I've got no stamina. What are those faulty core beliefs that are maintaining this problem? Then so H stands for have a vision, which is always easier to drive people towards something than away. Practical, overcoming the behaviours. That's the O of choice. So the relapse prevention stuff. The I is identify positive sexuality. The C is connect with others. We know that connection is the opposite of addiction and all that stuff. And the E is establish confident recovery, how you maintain recovery. And choice is also, for me, kind of a philosophy. Nobody chooses to be an addict, of course, but you can choose whether you act out or not. Ultimately, you choose whether you pick up that drink. You choose whether you go to that porn site.
Yeah.
You don't choose not to crave. If only you could switch that off. But ultimately, you know, so this is about getting back in your driving seat again of your life. You choose what you want to be and who you want to be. And that's very much the philosophy of it.
So it's very self-empowering.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. And then there's also a interactive on an app workbook. So basically you listen to yours truly and then you personalize your learning. There's exercises in the workbook to really personalize it to you, and then you move on to the next one.
It's so great to do, because if you are someone who really desires to change the way you're living at that time, that's incredible what you've done.
We did a pilot study as well with Leeds University. So we got we worked through it with Leeds University to pilot it, and the results were really, really good. 91% of people on the pilot study, and this is kind of followed on, we're seeing a very similar result with the people post-course now, had stopped all of their damaging behaviours, most damaging behaviours. And I think it was about 52% had stopped all of their unwanted behaviours.
Wow.
I very deliberately asked it like that, because if you're someone where it's been sex workers, sex parties, chem set, this, that and the other, I still look at a bit of porn every now and again. That, yeah, for some people there really is...
A slowdown of all their behaviour.
It's obviously it's not an alternative to therapy. So the results are really, really good, but also seeing a significant improvements in depression, anxiety, suicidality, impact it's having on relationships, sexual dysfunctions. 80% of people experience some kind of sexual problems and dysfunctions as a result of their addiction. We've just about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, launched Pivotal Foundations, which is a free 8 sessions, which gives very much for people at the milder end, problematic porn. I don't know if I'm an addict or not. I don't know, but I think I need to get a grip. Wrote Pivotal for Partners. Also wrote this as a 6-session course on helping your partner. Because this is where guys are a bit like guys, Paul, if I might say. Oh, honestly. I've told her I've stopped now. I don't see what all the fuss is about.
Yeah. Everything should be all right now.
It's going to be fine. Just leave it in the past. I only found out yesterday. I know, but it's over now, I promise. But why did you do it in the first place? I don't know. What matters is I've changed. No, it's not. I need to know why you did it in the first place. How do you know you won't do it again if you don't know why you did it in the first place?
Yeah.
Anyway, so helping your partner, showing empathy, communication, being accountable. Accountability is so important in this. So I wrote that helping your partner as well. And at the moment, really exciting. I don't know when this is going out, but I think it would be fine. Working with Birmingham University to write Pivotal for Students. We had no idea the impact that it would have. We were being contacted by so many other professionals saying, can we buy licenses from you so we can give it to our users?
Wow.
And so we sell tokens for much cheaper, so people can give it away, and some places, you know, getting funding to be able to do that. And some people in the kind of voluntary sector, we've had a few people working with ASD clients, autistic clients, saying, I've got no training in this. I've got no budget. I work as a local authority. Do you think this is, you know, work through it with your, so we created a clinician's guide so that they can support somebody on it, even though they've not done any kind of training in the field. But a massive issue amongst student counselling services. We ran a couple of training days, both of which were massively oversubscribed for university counselling services. And Birmingham got in touch and said, I'm writing a 40-session version for students, and we're going to pilot that with 200 students.
Wow.
Before hopefully rolling that out.
It shows how much it's needed. Just quickly, when you mentioned chemsex in the gay community, is there more of a problem there? Because it's different, I believe, from what I've heard, it's different from having, you know, heterosexual relationships. But is it harder in the gay community?
I think this is where the defining what is positive sexuality for you is really, really important. Certainly, historically, there was a real problem that people in the gay community were overdiagnosed, is that the right word? So with some of the early diagnostic tools we had, a lot of gay people were going, oh turns out I'm a sex addict then, and it's like, it's just that you have a lot of, and particularly around things like, so we know that one of the common denominators in sex and porn addiction is shame, is experiences of shame, as we talked about earlier. But for a lot of people growing up gay, do you feel shame? But, well, yeah, because my parents are religious and they're against it. And well, yeah, because I was brought up. And so it can be to do with minority stress, the way they were brought up, rather than anything else. There are newer diagnostic tools that are much, much better now. And I think it's really important for therapists to make sure they are using these up-to-date tools. But I think on the whole, it's why we need more education around this. On the whole, most people know when it really is a problem for them. You haven't got a problem because other people might think you're having too much sex. If you're having loads of sex, having a great time, thoroughly enjoying it and hurting no one, great. There is a limit to how much alcohol you can have without it screwing up your liver and almost, heading towards alcoholism. We obviously, the same is also true of drugs, but actually we don't count pornography addiction, or certainly not sex addiction, by quantity. One of the actual criteria is of the diagnosis a diminished pleasure response. Yeah. Right. So if you are you're just not enjoying it as much as you used to, and you're experiencing significant adverse consequences, but still can't stop, that's when you know that it's a problem. But it's not a problem because someone else says it is. So yeah, people in the gay communities used to be overdiagnosed. It's happening less so now. But yeah, it's really important for any therapist to be mindful of that.
If someone does have a porn addiction, or they know something's wrong, like you just said, not having the actual pleasure but still having to do something, what should they do about that?
I think if you recognise it's the problem, the first thing I'd say is, go to Pivotal Recovery, do Foundations, which is free. We haven't talked about, there are 12-step groups out there, of course, which are free. You've got SAA and SLAA, yep. Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. For many people, I was saying right from the beginning, it's about the chase. It's never about sex. It hasn't come up yet. It's not about the sex. It's about the validation. It's about being wanted. It's about getting the attention. It's about escaping feelings of anxiety or depression or low self-esteem. The same as compulsive overeating. You're not doing it because you're hungry. You're not doing it because you avoid food. It's for comfort. It's not for those reasons. Reach out for help.
Brilliant explanation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This Is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scolfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up, and you can get in touch with us, because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eber Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfort. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.